Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast. I'm Yong Kwon, columnist for the Korea's blog, and I'm joined today by Stephen Denny, PhD student at the University of Toronto and managing editor at the North Korea research site SinoNK. Good to have you here today, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
North Korea is widely viewed not just as an egregious violator of human rights and a mismanaged state, but also as an abnormal state, an image which has been perpetuated by its often unrealistic threats on the United States. Reinforcing this popular viewpoint, Max Fischer at the news site Vox recently published a 2-minute long video where he attempted to explain why North Korea acts quote-unquote crazy. He made two major claims in that video. First, Japan's fascist legacy from World War II lives on in North Korea, and this explains both Pyongyang's race-centric worldview and its cult of personality. Second, North Korea's provocative behavior is for its own domestic consumption, with the aim of legitimizing the state. For instance, the Songun policy, or the military first policy, was a means to distract people from the famine. Now, to start this discussion, Stephen, I think we should establish who Max Fischer is partially channeling when making this analysis.
He is partially channeling B.R. Myers and the arguments that Myers makes in his book, The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. B.R. Myers' book is based upon a study of North Korean propaganda, particularly that which is developed for internal consumption. So propaganda posters, short literary pieces, this sort of thing. And through this investigation, Myers concludes that rather than being that North Korean ideology, which is what he's attempting to explain here, rather than being guided by any form of communism, which is commonly asserted, is actually based on a sort of an ethnocentric nationalism that, if anything, is derived from Japanese fascism, not any form of communism. So that is what's being channeled here. It seems that sometimes people get caught up on sort of the fascist label and allege that B.R. Myers is asserting that North Korea is actually fascist. B.R. Myers is much smarter than that, and I think up front in his book, in the preface actually, he says, "I am not trying to make the claim that North Korea is a fascist state. You know, that's not helpful. Scholars can't even agree on what constitutes a fascist state or a fascist regime type." So I think that, you know, getting caught up on that is not helpful. And what he's channeling, though, is an argument that's been well developed by other Koreanists and in the study of Korean historiography, and that is, like, modern Korean nationalism, both North and South, was a response to Japanese colonialism in the 1920s, and that Koreans, like, race-based understanding of themselves was developed during the colonial period. And that is certainly correct as far as I can know, and it's been pretty well discussed and established in the literature. And that's actually one point of criticism that's directed towards B.R. Myers, is he doesn't engage in this literature. He just sort of asserts it offhand. He doesn't provide the readers with enough background information on the colonial period or the literature that has made arguments similar to his. But still, Max Fischer is partially or basically reiterating a lot of claims that B.R. Myers makes in his book.
I guess to dissect then this problematic historical narrative, we should deal with the two questions that are posed by Max Fischer, which is, was Japan fascist during World War II? And second, was North Korea a holdover of Imperial Japan? So with the first case, would you suggest that Japan was a fascist state during the Second World War? I mean, it's popularly perceived as such because of its alliance, its tripartite alliance with fascist states like Italy and Germany during World War II, but is that quite accurate?
There was certainly a fascist movement within Japan, and they were heavily influenced by fascist movements in Italy and Germany. And they adopted particular tactics from these, but Japan was never fascist itself. It sort of lacked the two necessary conditions for being considered fascist, like a sort of avant-garde party, a mass mobilizing party, under which everything, all other parties and movements were subsumed, and a sort of charismatic central figure. The emperor in Japan, of course, was constitutionally endowed with absolute power and authority, but he'd never really exercised this. He was, in the words of Japanese scholars of the time, indecisive about being decisive. And he never at any point exercised the sort of authority that, that Mussolini or Hitler did. So did Japan share similar characteristics with, you know, the fascist states of Germany and Italy? Yes. Was it fascist itself? No. Certainly not.
Right. I mean, I guess that kind of answers the second part of the question on whether or not North Korea adopted the Japanese ideology during the war, because clearly Kim Il-sung was a charismatic leader in North Korea, and because of the communist regime taking over and the collectivization of the culture and economy, it had a mass mobilizing movement. So I think that kind of answers the second part of the question. But it's a popularly perceived conception that North Korea is a crazy abnormal country, right? Do you think there's any positive driven from starting our observation of North Korea with the presumption that the country is crazy? It doesn't bring anything productive to the discussion, does it?
No. Crazy is not a good regime type. Like a crazy regime or a crazy state. I mean, that's not going to get us anywhere, is it? And, you know, luckily, cooler heads prevail when it comes to the more serious study of North Korea. And recent scholarship coming out of the discipline of political science in particular is good at understanding North Korea in comparison. So, for instance, at the University of Toronto, Lucan Wei with his co-investigator Stephen Levitsky have studied the durability of revolutionary authoritarian regimes. And, I mean, that's precisely what North Korea is. There's some disagreement, and I know Dr. Wei himself has a problem with labeling North Korea as a revolutionary authoritarian regime because it was sort of brought into the world under the tutelage of the USSR. But that's a separate debate to be had. But it exhibits this, many characteristics that other revolutionary authoritarian regimes exhibit, and it thus can be understood in a way that's quote-unquote normal. Further, and in the field of Korean studies, you have Honi Kwon with his co-author Byung Il-chung, who wrote the book on charismatic politics in North Korea. They put forward an idea, a theory, that by looking at what seems to be a unique characteristic of North Korea, that is the routinization of charisma. You know, Max Weber said charisma cannot be routinized, or it's very, very difficult to routinize Korea, which means to like pass on the charismatic authority from one charismatic leader to the next. So here in North Korea, you have this hereditary succession from father to son, and again from father to son, and that is a classic puzzle. How does that happen? So they channel the arguments of Clifford Geertsen and others who have wrote on the theater state by suggesting that through theatrics, charisma can be routinized. Now, that explains or puts forward an explanation for how this works in North Korea, but I would be weary at anyone who wants to just isolate it and say this only works in a North Korean context. And in fact, I think this can perhaps be applied to other cases. Maybe you don't have hereditary, but you do have succession from one charismatic leader to another. So, I mean, this is what, like, good work. These are examples of good works that are approaching North Korea in a very helpful way for those who are concerned with studying North Korea seriously.
And you mentioned politics, like the theatrical politics, and I think that flows in very well to the second point that Max Fischer actually made in the video, which is that North Korean foreign policy and North Korea's military or state doctrine are usually for domestic consumption. Like, he makes a statement that the reason why the Songun policy, the military first policy, comes out during the 1990s is because the country is suffering from starvation and that it needed to justify the existence of this repressive state, this militarized state, by painting this worldview full of aggressive countries that are trying to take over North Korea and to corrupt the pure race of the Korean people. Now, would you say that that's accurate?
Partially accurate. I think Songun is in part designed for internal consumption, but it's much more than that. And again, if we're to approach North Korea from, let's say, from a political science perspective, and we're interested in understanding the regime types, like what sort of regime is North Korea, you know, one could argue that pre-Songun, that pre-Arduous March North Korea was a personalist party authoritarian regime, a personalist party regime, where, you know, the party is at the forefront with the charismatic leader on top. I think one could argue quite convincingly that post-Songun changed the regime type in North Korea from personalist party to personalist military. And I see when you have the promotion of the National Defense Commission to the point it's at now, it seems to indicate that the military has become more important than the party itself. I say this to indicate that it's not just about convincing people that the military, that you need a strong military and you need to give all these resources to the military to protect them. It's a very sort of rational decision that, okay, if we do not prioritize the institution which is most likely to preserve the regime, we might fall. Thus, it's a change in the type of regime, a change in regime type, you know, instituted from, you know, within.
Right. But also, just looking at it from North Korea's perspective in terms of foreign policy, this isn't abnormal in the sense that we do have in the 1990s the successive collapses of communist regimes throughout the world in 1989 to 1991. And we also have a country like North Korea that's experienced a very traumatic war on the Korean Peninsula, where had it not been for the intervention of Chinese volunteers, it would have been essentially wiped off the map. On top of that, you have the elimination of assistance, economic assistance coming from the Soviet Union with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and we have the People's Republic of China recognizing South Korea and establishing diplomatic relations. So is it really that strange that a country in North Korea's position would become very paranoid in the 1990s? I mean, on top of that, we have the domestic factors that you mentioned, but also the external factors for North Korea aren't very pleasant either.
No, certainly not. And I don't want to... You have to be... I think one has to be careful in using the argument that, you know, the North Korean regime is going full speed ahead with Sungun policy because of the external circumstances, the external conditions. I think that explains probably the most for looking at, like, what variable gives us the most explanatory power. It seems to be that. You know, this is the argument that's put forth by hawks and doves, by centrists and others falling on all, you know, along the points of the spectrum. But it's sort of a rational decision to promote that institution which is most likely to secure your sovereignty when faced with what seem to be existential threats to your existence.
Right. I mean, I think the problem that I have with this video that Max Fischer produced for Vox is that he seems to suggest that North Korea's desire or its rhetoric of defending sovereignty is disingenuous. And I think that's it's a difficult position to maintain given that we have archival evidence from the 60s and 70s from North Korea's erstwhile allies, like the Soviet Union, Eastern European states, and China, where we have a clear signs of North Korea legitimately concerned with the prospects of, you know, being attacked by South Korea, by being attacked from the United States. And it is concerned with the future prospects of the unification of the Korean Peninsula. So I think the key problem I have with Max Fischer's video is suggesting that North Korea's behavior is entirely disingenuous and entirely leaning towards regime maintenance. And I think that's very flawed.
Yeah, well, it's regime maintenance insofar as these perceived existential threats, if they manifested themselves, if they materialized, would effectively eliminate the regime in North Korea. But it's a rational response to the outside environment that most leaders in any state would make.
We had a very productive conversation on taking apart and kind of discrediting this narrative, this explanation of North Korea. Would you have any suggestions on how to better approach North Korea?
You see, you have Wei and Levitsky who take a large and a comparative case study, and they're not including North Korea. As I said, they want to exclude it because of the tutelage that was given to North Korea during its, you know, the early years of state building. But it's to take to use those methods and typologies and types that have been developed in various disciplines and then fit North Korea in it. And I think where we're at now in terms of how we approach and study North Korea within academia, at least, is for those Koreanists to ground themselves in a particular discipline, Now, for the case of Honik Kwan and Pyeongchung, they approached it from using anthropological methods. If we were to channel our inner Wei and Levitsky, we would use, you know, comparative methods. I mean, currently, those of us at Sino and K, Adam Cathcart, Christopher Green, and I, we are using the institutional theories that explain how states interact with society to maintain legitimacy. And that's, I mean, channeling our inner Weber. So, I mean, that's the best way to sort of de-essentialize North Korea, to ensure that, or to fight against this rhetoric and this discourse that wants to label it as crazy. Does it do things that seem different to the outside world? Yes, but, I mean, that's the case for any country at any time. You're going to be doing something that someone from the outside, the other, is going to interpret as different, and as perhaps strange or bizarre.
I think that was a very important advice, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me again.